Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News.
Our top story. For this half hour, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran seeks stronger guarantees from the U.S. to have a sustainable deal aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks during a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. He said that Tehran is carefully reviewing Washington's response to an EU draft text on reviving the JCPOA. The top Iranian diplomat also urged the International Atomic Energy Agency to drop its politically motivated probes in order for Iran and other parties to reach a sustainable agreement. For his part, Lavrov said the two countries are working to create reliable mechanisms that will allow them to expand cooperation regardless of any diktats from the West. He said that Tehran and Moscow have already identified clear guidelines in that respect. Well, joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow, we have journalist and political commentator Fred Weir. Mr. Weir, welcome to the program. Give us your perspective on the significance of this enhancing of cooperation between Iran and Russia, and also, if you may, address the issue which was also brought up by the Iranian foreign minister, who is in Moscow, at the moment of Russia's assistance and collaboration in trying to get the JCPOA, the revival negotiations, to a particular point.
Russia was, of course, one of the facilitators and signatories of the original agreement. Russia, it was one of the great examples of cooperation between several different countries in coming together and striking that deal with Iran. And so Russia does have a role to play and an interest in seeing it revived. And hopefully it will be, because the world was a safer place. And the possibilities for Iran to re-enter the global mainstream, the marketplace, also very important. So I think those consultations probably pretty important, getting Russia and Iran on the same page about how to proceed with this American offer, and it does seem like a very optimistic moment. Otherwise, there are several other things. You know that Iran and Russia have recently strengthened their bilateral cooperation economically, strategically. There's a new level there and a good deal to discuss about it. And there was also some suggestion that Iran might play a constructive role in helping to navigate toward some sort of negotiated peace in Ukraine. It is necessary because, all the traditional mechanisms have just totally broken down. And nobody will trust the West or Europe as a fair mediator in this case. So it's countries like Iran, Turkey, maybe Israel, I don't know, perhaps China, who will have to step in if there's going to be some kind of process leading to a negotiated settlement. It's going to take outside parties like Iran, who can manage good relations with both sides and help steer things toward a good end. And I hear that they were discussing in a preliminary way something like that.
Another notion that was brought up by the Russian foreign minister in his joint press conference with the visiting Iranian foreign minister was the issue of de-dollarizing efforts. What can you tell us about that? There have been efforts mentioned by the Iranian Central Bank that Iran and Russia would be moving in a direction of de-dollarizing some of their trade activities. Unpack that for us, please.
Sure. This is a problem that many countries now are working on. It is because having the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency turns out to be more trouble than it's worth for a lot of countries. It is good to have a stable currency that everybody can rely on and do business in, because so many other currencies are volatile, including the Russian ruble and the Iranian rial. But the problem is that when transactions happen in U.S. dollars, The United States Treasury Department has control over them. It can veto them. It can interfere with them, postpone them, derail them. And this has happened in a big way in the past 6 months with seizure of Russian foreign currency assets around the world. Basically, the Russians want to get out of dollars completely, and they're well on the way to doing that. But they also want to transform their trade with other countries into local currencies or some other basket of currencies that don't come with political strings attached. And so they're doing these kind of deals. I think it's well advanced with China. I think these deals are underway with India, rupee-ruble mechanisms. And I think it's perfectly logical and natural for Iran, which has a similar experience to Russia with the U.S. sanctions, to help develop those mechanisms for its future trade with Russia.
Thanks a lot, journalist and political commentator Fred Weir, joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. Staying with Russia, though, the country is tightening the screws on Europe's energy supply as the economic battle between Moscow and the West intensifies. The European operator of the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, ENSOG, says Moscow has halted gas deliveries to Europe. Russian energy giant Gazprom is citing maintenance issues for slashing the flow, saying a three-day work is necessary at one of the compressor stations. The corporation says it's cutting off Germany's gas supplies for 72 hours. Germany is calling the decision technically incomprehensible and accusing Moscow of using energy as a political weapon. Moscow argues that the Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine are impeding its normal maintenance and repair work and therefore cause disruptions to the flow. We've reached out to political analyst and author Markus Papadopoulos to get his take on the latest halt in Russian gas supplies to Europe. Let's listen in.
The Kremlin could be issuing a reminder to Germany and the rest of Europe of the sheer importance of Nord Stream 1 in terms of European industries and European domestic households. Europe faces not a disaster. Europe faces a catastrophe which could have been averted, because all that we see today in Europe stems from the war in Ukraine, a war which could have been averted. And now, as I said, a catastrophic economic situation is on the horizon for Europe, in which millions upon millions of Europeans either face the prospect of dying because of exposure to the cold elements, or falling into poverty, or becoming homeless. Trying to isolate Russia in the world economically was a catastrophic decision by the Western ruling elites.
UN atomic watchdog team is on its way to Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear plant amid growing concerns over a leakage of radioactive substances. The delegation that is headed by the International Atomic Energy Agency's chief Rafael Grossi is set to inspect the Russian-controlled plant. Moscow and Kiev have been blaming one another for shelling the facility. Just days ago, Ukraine's president said Europe was one step away from a radiation disaster when the plant was briefly disconnected from the power grid. However, Russians say radiation levels are normal and the situation there is under control. The plant has been in Russian hands since March. It's, however, being operated by Ukrainian staff. Mikhail Gorbachev, the first and last president of the Soviet Union, has died at the age of 91. According to Russian media, Gorbachev died on Tuesday evening in Moscow after a serious illness. Gorbachev ruled the Soviet Union from 1985 until its collapse in 1991. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1990 for his role in bringing an end to the Cold War. President Vladimir Putin has expressed his deep condolences on his death. World leaders have also paid tribute to him. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has sent a message praising Gorbachev as a one-of-a-kind statesman who changed the course of history. Well, the U.S. has invaded several foreign countries over the past decades. A major new study has concluded that U.S. military interventions increasingly target the Middle East and Africa, making up more than a quarter of such campaigns throughout its history. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria are some of the recent examples where American interventions caused chaos, bloodshed, and instability.
The death toll from the latest clashes between rival armed groups in the Libyan capital Tripoli passed 30, with over 150 people also injured. The fighting raised fears of a major nationwide conflict between a UN-recognized and parliament-backed government. Libya's unraveling has become a symbol of the limits of U.S. power and the folly of military intervention in distant countries. The U.S. is to blame for Libya's current turmoil. After an American-led intervention in 2011 to stop Muammar Gaddafi's atrocities, created a security vacuum in the country. Since then, the security vacuum has been filled by legions of armed militias, foreign mercenaries, extremists, human traffickers, and regional and international powers who have all transformed the North African country into an exporter of instability and mayhem. The footprints of Washington's intervention in war are in several other countries as well. U.S. interventions in past decades have failed to bring democracy to countries around the world. Countries like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan have been some of the victims of U.S. interventions, still experiencing chaos. A major new study has concluded that U.S. military interventions increasingly target the Middle East and Africa, making up more than a quarter of the country's campaigns throughout its history. The United States is spending an exorbitant amount of money on arms while making trouble in the world with its hundreds of foreign military bases. The U.S. military had about 750 bases overseas across 80 countries and territories in 2021. Earlier this year, the Biden administration expanded the U.S. military footprint in Africa by reversing a decision by former U.S. President Donald Trump to pull troops out of Somalia, thereby establishing a permanent military base in the country.
Since 2001, the U.S. has spent an estimated $8 trillion on wars. Washington has around 800 military bases worldwide. It drops an average of about 50 bombs a day in different countries around the world. And the fact that it's conducted three major wars in the last decade without any success shows the flawed approach it has towards different countries under the banner of spreading democracy.
According to new research, the United States has conducted nearly 400 military interventions since 1776. Half of those conflicts and other uses of force, including displays and threats of force as well as covert and other operations, occurred between 1950 and 2019. More than a quarter of them have taken place since the end of the Cold War. The United States has carried out 34% of its interventions against countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, 23% in East Asia and the Pacific region, 14% in the Middle East and North Africa, and just 13% in Europe and Central Asia. Today, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute puts the cost of the U.S. military at more than $800 billion annually, accounting for almost 40% of global military spending. In 2019, the U.S. government spent around $718 billion on its military, and about 3% of that spending could house the entire homeless population in the U.S. According to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, it would cost $20 billion to end homelessness in the U.S.
The U.S. government says it's in possession of evidence showing that Donald Trump's team tried to obstruct a probe into the discovery of classified documents at the former president's residence. The Justice Department says government records were likely concealed and removed from a storage room at Trump's Mar-a-Lago home. The department has accused Trump of obstructing justice by failing to return top-secret documents to the government. Trump has been calling for a federal judge to appoint a special master to review the records in question. The court hearing will be held on Thursday. Earlier this month, the FBI searched Trump's residence in Florida. The agents found 33 boxes containing more than 100 classified records. The former president and his Republican allies accuse the FBI of being corrupt and call the search nothing but political retribution. Moving on to Iraq, where the prime minister is threatening to step down if the ongoing political chaos is not resolved.
And I warn that from now on, if they want to continue to stir up chaos, conflict, discord, and strife, and not listen to the voice of reason, I will take my moral and patriotic steps by announcing the vacancy of the position of prime minister at the appropriate time, according to Article 81 of the Iraqi Constitution, and hold them accountable before the Iraqis and before history.
Mustafa al-Kadhimi also said a commission of inquiry will be formed to probe the origin of the weapons used in the recent deadly clashes in the capital Baghdad. Chaos broke out on Monday after cleric Muqtada al-Sadr said he was quitting politics in response to a prolonged political deadlock in the country. He criticized other political leaders for not heeding his calls for reform. Sadr's supporters broke into the Green Zone and stormed the presidential palace. The unrest prompted a nationwide curfew and the closure of government organizations. The ensuing clashes resulted in nearly 30 deaths and left hundreds of people wounded. Later on Tuesday, the situation calmed down after Sadr called on his supporters to withdraw from the streets.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
This Friday prayer is a weekly event. When such a community exists, where a large group of people in a city gather in a certain place every week, it can be a base, it can be a meeting place, to discuss all the important issues of the society. When everyone is expected to gather together, people think of what things to say. Societies have needs. There is everything from intellectual issues to social services, from the people's cooperation to their military mobilization for defending the country. All of these are realized and carried out in this continuous weekly gathering. And these things come about. That is, they can come about. There is an opportunity of this importance and greatness in this gathering. Therefore, this is an enormous treasure and an extraordinary opportunity that has been given to us.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another feature of the Friday prayers is the combination of spirituality and politics. This is something that is rare for materialistic people and those who don't ponder over matters. How can politics, spirituality, and the belief in God exist in one place? Politics has a basis that in appearances is contradictory to the remembrance of Allah and the like. So mixing politics with spirituality in an obligatory act is a virtuosity that belongs to Islam. It's Islam's work of art. The following tradition has been narrated from Imam Ridha alayhi salam about the Friday prayer leader. He informs them of the prospects and fears that have come upon them, in which they will have both harm and benefit. This is an important, great matter. The events that are taking place in the world and that have a relationship with our society, either as a loss or a benefit, are expressed to the people by the Friday prayer leader. Let's consider the example of the issue of nuclear power. Or the war in Ukraine. This is an issue that is happening in the world, or there are different matters relating to the politics of the East and the West. These are things that affect our country, our society, our life, and our politics. Well, the Friday prayer leader explains, describes, and talks about these things for the people with sufficient and correct information. He links politics with spirituality. He says, "Be pious towards God." People must be reminded to practice piety in the Friday prayer sermon. At the same time, he explains politics to people. This kind of politics, international politics. This is also one of the issues that is one of Friday prayer's features. It has other features too, of course, which I have spoken about briefly.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
rising costs in the U.S. have pushed Americans to the edge with soaring inflation and the government's inability to control the matter so far. Inflation in the U.S. has shattered all previous records in March and currently is hovering around 8.5%. With inflation hitting the highest rate since 1981, the rising cost of living has been squeezing households and putting pressure on policymakers to bring the issue under control. And now government officials have warned Americans that the worst is yet to come. The U.S. Federal Reserve's Chair Jerome Powell has warned of pain ahead for Americans in the battle against inflation. While pledging that the Fed will continue to act forcefully, he also warned that the U.S. job market will suffer in order to get prices down. He says the damage which will be dealt to the job market is an unfortunate cost of reducing inflation.
Well, monetary policy only has an effect of 6 to 9 months of a lag. He just started raising interest rates here significantly in the last 2 months. So it won't really start to have an impact on inflation here until fourth quarter, maybe, of this year. But it won't have that much impact, I don't believe. I don't believe that it's going to be very quickly reducing inflation from its current 8.5% down to the Federal Reserve's 2% target here within the next 6 months or even within the next 18 months. I don't think they're going to get it down to that. They're going to continue raising rates because the only real solution, even if it is a limited solution, is monetary policy interest rates. They aren't going to hike taxes to slow down the economy. Government spending is just shifting from social program spending to military spending and subsidies to corporations kind of spending. So fiscal policy isn't going to do anything. Monetary policy can only have a limited effect, but the Fed is going to push that solution as high and as long as it can to shake out whatever it can shake out in terms of inflation.
According to recent surveys, Americans believe inflation tops the list of problems the country is faced with. This has led to U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings plunging heavily, leaving the Republicans criticizing him over the issue. Nevertheless, the U.S. government seems to be more concerned about the conflict in Ukraine, where it has so far given away billions of dollars in weaponry. The price of gasoline in the U.S. has witnessed a record high, averaging more than $5 a gallon in recent weeks for the first time ever. Meanwhile, Biden's attempts of lowering prices, which have included draconian measures like releasing crucial gasoline emergency reserves and even begging the Saudis to increase their oil output, have so far proven to be ineffective. While Americans are suffering and getting crushed under the dire economic situation, the government headed by Biden has just pledged another $3 billion U.S. dollars in aid to Ukraine. Washington has already assisted Ukraine with more than $18 billion in military aid since the launch of the Russian special military operation. But why is it that while Biden has described combating inflation as his top domestic priority, the government can't think about its own citizens before spending money on these wars?
This is only the beginning of subsidizing Ukraine. It's like 60 to 70 billion already in just 6 months. Ukraine says it needs 7 billion a month just to keep its economy going. Treasury Secretary Yellen of the U.S. Said, we're going to give you $4 billion. So the U.S. is propping up Ukraine economically and militarily and so forth. It's becoming, an economic satrapy of the United States. The U.S. is deeply penetrated economically in Ukraine. That's why it won't leave. And that's why, it provoked this situation with this war purposely. The U.S. Really sees it's got, its 2 feet on the ground there in Ukraine. And its whole policy with regard to this war is just to continue the war in a low grade, well, maybe not so even low grade, for as long as necessary.
All in all, the U.S. is reeling from its support of Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, while its economy is seeing a severe downfall. But this is only the latest in a catalog of problems, from increasing social divisions and political paralysis to an inability to recover from the economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. And all this has led many to believe the US is losing its power and standing in the world. The Palestinian Authority has renewed its push for full membership at the United Nations amid long-time acts of obstructionism and opposition by the United States. Any application for full membership at the UN would need approval from the Security Council, and that means the US participation. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN says he has been consulting with Security Council members over a possible full membership bid over the past weeks. But the US, a full-fledged supporter of the occupying Israeli regime and a UNSC member with a veto power, on the other hand, has once again reiterated its opposition to the move, saying it will block it. The US's reason behind rejection of the Palestinians' push for membership: it should only occur after the resolution of an agreement for a two-state solution. But the real reason behind the US's opposition to Palestine's move is that membership would mean full international recognition of Palestine as an independent country on the international stage. In other words, Palestinian statehood, and that would be consequential for Israel. Yet the US is at much fault for Palestinian situation, as is Israel. PA's ambassador to the UN has said, given that the peace process has been frozen for 8 years and that there is no initiative on the table, the issue of full UN membership should move forward.
Well, the United States provides $3.8 billion of military aid to the Israeli occupation every year on an annual basis. So what this means is that the United States is a full partner in all of the war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetrated by the Israeli regime. And this has been the case for decades upon decades. I mean, throughout the nearly 75 years of Nakba against the Palestinian people, the United States and other imperialist powers like Britain and France and Germany have been full partners with the occupation and these crimes against the Palestinian people. I mean, Palestinians have the right not only to full representation and recognition at the United Nations, but more importantly and fundamentally for the liberation of all of Palestine. And, you know, really what we need to be talking about is kicking Israel, kicking the Zionist regime out of the United Nations, not just recognizing Palestine.
In 2012, Palestine was granted non-member status, but this was done in the General Assembly, where no member has veto power. And now this has raised the assumption that Palestine may be following the same path to gain full membership. The Palestinian Authority's push comes just several weeks ahead of the UN General Assembly, where world leaders are set to convene in New York for their annual summit. Israel says any vote for the Palestinian cause and against its illegal actions impedes negotiations and progress in a chance for better lives for Israelis and Palestinians. The regime claims that a vote against it would obstruct peace, but these claims come in contrast to what is happening on the ground. Just looking at the past few weeks, Israel has ramped up its attacks on Palestinian towns and cities, leaving dozens dead and many others injured. Palestine, on the other hand, has been adamant that its full membership was essential if there was to be any chance of leading a dormant peace process. But why is Israel so persistent against Palestine gaining full UN membership?
Well, what we've been seeing throughout the years is that in the United Nations, the United States has consistently used its veto power in the Security Council in order to prevent the Israeli regime from being held accountable for its crimes, just as it has used that same power in the Security Council to attempt to impose its will upon other countries and to protect its own war crimes and crimes against humanity from being held up to any meaningful form of accountability. And so, of course, the Israeli occupation wants to completely erase Palestinian identity and existence, and that's been the case for the past 75 years. But what that's, you know, really important is actually to fight back against and boycott and isolate, including in the United Nations, the occupation regime. Because simply saying that, oh, Palestine is recognized in the United Nations is not doing enough to actually liberate Palestinians from the grasp of colonialism, occupation, and apartheid.
The last round of Israeli-Palestinian talks collapsed in 2014. Among the major sticking points in those negotiations was Israel's continued settlement expansion activities in the occupied lands. Iran's proposal for the issue of Palestine told a mass referendum, something Iran's leader has said would be a logical solution to the conflict.
It has been a rocky economic road that the Brits are traveling on, which continues to chip away at their income. Some were questioning how they would manage their expenses in the UK these days. Why, with an unprecedented inflation and a cost of living crisis, now their nightmare has gotten worse. An 80% increase in electric and gas bills have been announced, one that is coming before the winter season.
It is a major problem because what is happening, of course, is first of all, real incomes are falling because people are not getting wage settlements in line with inflation, but below inflation. Then tax burden has increased, you know, to record levels as well. The government has been raising taxes to pay for the furlough scheme and all the money that they splurged.
To be exact, an 80% increase would mean that it would average about £3,600, or about $4,200 per year from October. This is terrible news, especially for the poor and the ones at the bottom half of the social strata. The UK was suffering already from high energy prices, in particular heating bills, even before the Ukraine crisis began. So bad was the situation that fuel poverty, as it was called, was leading to deaths for people who could not afford to heat their homes. These are the stats that are truly shocking, that one would not expect from a European country. For example, this article in 2020 pointed out to how thousands of people in the UK died from the cold and that fuel poverty was to blame. On average, there were 32,000 more deaths between December and March than the rest of the year. Many perished because of the refusal of a society with abundant wealth and resources to provide for its most vulnerable citizens. An average of 9,700 deaths each year were believed to be caused by living in a cold house.
We know we need to do more because actually the most vulnerable households have no cushion, have nothing available to them. So what I'm looking at is how I can target that help for those people, not just to January.
The unprecedented hike for energy prices in the UK will surely affect the UK's economy. One obvious outcome of this price increase is that it will chip away at people's spending power and income. This is while people's income has not kept pace with the inflation rate. Increases have been minimal or not at all. This may explain why there have been so many strikes and protests recently in different sectors in the UK. The latest, the postal workers' strike. 115,000 workers across 1,500 locations. Criminal barristers and mass rail strikes have also plagued the UK, as the country is battling a historic cost of living crisis. The outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson has sure left an economic mess for the next administration to deal with. But was it all his fault? The UK did not have a sound economy even before the pandemic started. Among the group of G7 economies, the UK has suffered the highest inflation rate than any other G7 country, as price rises have reached a 40-year record, with inflation recorded at 10.1% in the year for the month of July. That is the highest since the year 1982. And with the Ukraine crisis showing no signs of ending, the future looks bleak for the country, especially since the new administration will not officially begin work until October. And Boris Johnson's view on this, the new administration will clearly have to help people with energy bills.
That I know that even if things can sometimes seem dark now,
the army of the Islamic Republic of Iran has staged a massive drill which features scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat drones. The drill covers the strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, as well as the country's central regions. Over 150 new advanced drones are flown in the drill. The Army's 1401 joint drone exercise involves units from the Ground Force, Navy, Air Force and Air Defense Force. The units have already carried out their intelligence gathering and patrol missions. They include homegrown Yasir, Sadr, Yazdan and Ababil 3 tactical surveillance unmanned aerial vehicles, Pelican vertical takeoff and landing naval drone, as well as Muhajir 6 were also flown from different bases. Muhajir 6 is an ISTAR drone, which means the drone can operate intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition and reconnaissance missions. It can significantly boost Iran's capability in confronting threats. The drill features the Army's latest achievements in drone engineering and production. Due to the expansion of unmanned aerial capabilities, execution of various and numerous drone missions, and the need to coordinate such flights, the Army has set up a command and control network for the drone operations. The exercise exhibits only a small fraction of the achievements made by the Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Iran has, for some time now, shown that it is a world leader in drone technology, both in terms of indigenous capabilities developed by Iranian industries and the reverse engineering that Iran has done off of some of the United States frontline drones, which Iran has acquired one way or another. But it's not just the technology, it's how it's adapted for the modern battlefield.
This is the first time that a joint drone exercise is conducted at the level of the four forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army and the country's joint air defense base. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the armed sphere.
And so it's drones and the technology and the tactics are adapted to these realities. And so, it's one thing, though, to have theoretical knowledge. It's another to have practical. And these exercises, I think, take Iran's drones and allows the Iranian military to practice using these drones in realistic scenarios that will make these drones more effective if Iran is ever called upon to use them in a conflict.
Iran says it has become an exporter of military drones in the world and that the country holds the upper hand in aerospace. Back in July, when U.S. President Joe Biden was visiting the West Asia region, Iran's army unveiled its first division of ships and submarines capable of carrying armed drones.
It's the height of hypocrisy, hubris-based hypocrisy, for the United States, Israel, or any Western nation that incorporates drone technology into their operations to call out Iran for developing their own drone capability and employing these drones in support of Iranian backed actions in the region. The United States invented the armed drone, and the United States has used armed drones extensively throughout its involvement in the Middle East and Central Asia and elsewhere.
Earlier this year, Iran's new combat drone called Gaza successfully passed flight tests and became fully operational. The vehicle has a 21-meter wingspan and a 3,100-kilogram takeoff mass with the capability of carrying a payload of 500 kilograms. And before that, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unveiled one of its new kamikaze drones, dubbed Mehraj 504, which is specialized in attacking enemies' defense systems. The Islamic Republic's military doctrine holds that the country's armed capability solely serves defensive purposes and poses no threat to other states.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Mm-hmm. My dear son, I convey all this to you, lest inordinate desires, temptations, and inducement should start influencing you, or adverse changes of times and circumstances should drag your name in the mire, or I should leave you like an untrained colt, because a young and fresh mind is like a virgin soil which allows things sown in it to grow verdantly and to bear luxuriantly. Then, I have made use of early opportunities to educate you and train you before your mind loses its freshness, before it gets hardened or warped, before you start facing life unprepared for the encounter, and before you are forced to use your decisions and discretions without gaining advantages of accumulated traditions, collected knowledge, and experiences of others. These words of advice and counsels that I give you will save you from the worry of acquiring knowledge, gathering experiences, and soliciting advice from others. Now, you can easily make use of all the knowledge which men have to acquire with great care, trouble, and patience. Things which were hidden from them, and which only experiments, experiences, and sufferings could bring to light, are now made easily available to you through these exhortations. My dear son, though the span of my life is not as that of some other people who have passed away before me, yet I took great care to study their lives. Assiduously, I went through their activities. I contemplated over their deliberations and deeds. I studied their remains, relics, and ruins. I pondered over their lives so deeply that I felt as if I have lived and worked with them from early ages of history down to our times, and I know what did them good and what brought them harm.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Dear friends, in the past few programs, we have been talking about the importance of knowledge and how we need to be very careful from ignorance. And we've also talked about in some of our previous programs how ignorance can become compounded and complex when we decide to not learn that which we do not know. Of course, when discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam emphasized highly the acquisition of knowledge. Of course, knowledge, when put into practice, leads to wisdom. But just as the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam revolves around knowledge and wisdom, we find that His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, has also encouraged us to stay far away from ignorance. And in addition to refraining and staying far away from ignorance, Imam Ali has told us to be very careful when it comes to making decisions in our lives when they are based upon ignorance. There are many repercussions if one does this, makes decisions in their lives for themselves and for others based upon ignorance. Talking about just some of the qualities of these kind of individuals who choose the path of ignorance, Imam Ali says that they do not realize that that which is beyond their reach is within the reach of others. Meaning, just because they don't have knowledge about a certain matter
does not mean that others, such as the Ahlul Bayt, have that knowledge. And then Imam Ali says that if something is not clear to this individual, they keep quiet. And they don't keep quiet because they are avoiding in saying something wrong, but they keep quiet because they know that they are ignorant about a certain thing and that their ignorance shall be revealed to all. And so they stay quiet. And lastly, lives are lost and people are left mourning because of the unjust verdicts of such an individual of ignorance that makes decisions based upon their ignorance. And so, dear friends, we must do our best to acquire knowledge, to put our knowledge into practice, and to make sure to stay away from ignorance. And if we realize that we do not know something, then we should go and search for that knowledge, acquire that knowledge, and of course, if we are in a position where we are making decisions for other people and we do not know something, we should admit that we do not know and then go and try to search for that knowledge. A very intriguing lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome, my friends. Keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. You know, when Josh Malihabadi talks about Imam Hussein, where he says, let the humanity reach to its maturity,